There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's a difference between putting the world to right because you have a feeling of rightness inside you than putting the world to right because you think there's something wrong at the center of the world. Yeah. And those are two very different identities shaped by a different point of origin.
Hi, I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a podcast about living a more beautiful and fired up life. Here we will continue my 10-year nomadic journey, living out of one bag, in search of more connection, more awakeness, less consuming, less loneliness, and less bloody scrolling. I'll be inviting you to join me in finding better ways to radically love and save our one wild and precious life on this planet. So David White is a poet, a philosopher who trained as a marine biologist and was a naturalist guide in the Galapagos, the Amazon and the Himalayas before switching to being a professional poet, there's such a thing, because as I heard him explain once, the language of science wasn't large enough to convey existence. He's written more than a dozen poetry and prose books, and his latest is called Still Possible, which I think will come out in Australia or be available in Australia in a few months. He recently teamed with Sam Harris on his Meditation Toolkit series, and he coaches corporate America in leadership via poetry and conducts poetry walking tours of Ireland, Japan, Italy, and Wordsworth's Lake District. And if you've read my books, you're probably aware he's the guy who got me into poetry. Steven Spielberg, funnily enough, says the same, and he's joined David on one of his walks as well. I'd previously skipped over the poem breakouts in books. They quite honestly annoyed me and got in the way of the plot. I'm a horribly impatient person, and that's the kind of thing I used to do. But David's work has had a massive impact on me, and it taught me stillness and patience for one, and it got me to love and honour my aloneness for another, which has been a lifelong struggle. Not long after I started listening to and reading David's work, I was sitting at a cafe in a regional town where my nomadic journey had landed me for a bit, and a mutual friend walked over and, I kid you not, he said, "Hey Sarah, you might like to meet this guy I'm having coffee with, David White," which of course I chose at the time to take as an awesome sign of something. David and I then met up a few times for a beer, a dinner, and finally I joined him and his wife Gail and his daughter Charlotte on one of his walking trips in the Lake District while writing This One Wild and Precious Life. Many of you have requested that David come on this chat in the various invitations I put out there to tell me who you'd like on this podcast. And there are so many wild ideas he has gifted me over the years. So today is a very special conversation, as David would put it. The wild idea we'll pivot from, and as you know, I like to try and pivot from one such wild idea every episode and expand out from there, is something many of you have probably heard me say, and I borrow it completely from David. One of the most important disciplines of a human life is to ask beautiful questions, to look for them, to ask them in unbeautiful moments, to ask them courageously and vulnerably, because beautiful questions will get you places and it'll get you to the right places. And as David says, there is always a more beautiful question to ask. David is Irish but grew up in Yorkshire and now lives on an island off Seattle. So his lilt is also large and global and broguish, but also so grounding, and you'll hear that in this episode. I get him to recite a few of his poems, and he does it really beautifully. And it's a moment, especially if you're not into poetry, to sit in the silence if you can. And he repeats the lines a couple of times, so you have heaps of opportunity to kind of get it. And my bold aim really is to get you into poetry via this episode if you're not already, and armed for asking the more beautiful, courageous questions of this wild existence. Anyway, let's get to it. David White, welcome to Wild.
It's very good to be with you, Sarah.
I don't know if you recall, the last time we met was a couple of years ago in the Lake District, and there was a moment that was etched into my memory on top of, I think it was Coniston. It was the last hike that we did together. And you were reciting Robert Frost, Fire and Ice, and I think the line was something about, if I had to perish twice, ice is great. And I was going blue and my autoimmune disease had kicked in, and your lovely daughter Charlotte had to sort of escort me down the mountain to the pub where we waited for the rest of the gang to join us. That was the last time I saw you, and it was very, very memorable. But we'd had a week of hiking together following the footsteps of the Wordsworths, of course.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you could explain, I guess, your fondness for these wild natural scapes, as harsh as they can be, and why they meld so well with poetry.
Well, I think wildness always tells you that there are forces and context and powers that are larger than your own, and that they will come and find you and name you in ways in which your endeavors in the little pocket of reality that you live in are powerless to describe. And so, I mean, Wordsworth himself has this incredible line where he says, he's looking out over the wild landscape of the English Lake District and over the Irish Sea, and with the sun coming up, he says, I made no vows, but vows were then made for me. I made no vows, but vows were then made for me. Bond unknown to me was given, that I should be, else sinning greatly, a dedicated spirit. And on I walked in blessedness, which even yet remains. Yeah.
It's true, isn't it? Yeah, I'm sure he wrote that 2 weeks after going for an epic hike, because I've always found the benefit of walking in the wilds can last for a week, 2 weeks at a time before, you know, I've got to get back out there again and get a fix.
The wind and the rain gets into you, at least if you're hiking in Ireland or Wales or England. And, you know, they talk about the wildness in the west of Ireland. It's not the wildness you get in a true wilderness, like, say, the central Australian desert or the forests of North America. It's the wildness in the way the elements move. You know, it's actually it's a landscape that's been settled for 5,000 years since the last ice age.
Yeah.
But the wildness is in the meeting, this ancient conversation between mountains and sea, between the solidity of the land and the power of the wind and the rain, you know. And there's a species of wet and cold in Ireland and the north of England that's colder than the Antarctic, you know. It just get right into your bones. And that's the kind of wildness where suddenly the inner and the outer are in this conversation. And it's why you feel so alive in the pub afterwards, you know, when you're drinking your hot whiskey or your vegetarian equivalent of it. and your body glows, you know, and your conversation glows. And always tried to run my extended poetry courses as walking holidays, because that combination of imaginative and intellectual stimulus combined with the outer elements, you know, is a heady combination. And then you get good food and drink and convivial conversation. that's wild. And you can get the wildness in the pub in the evening or back at wherever you're staying, you know. And it comes from that wildness that you've touched out in the great beyond. Yes.
I've heard you describe the fact that I think humans are drawn to the natural world or find ourselves really opening up into it because nature is, it's just itself, and that humans are very unique on the planet because we actually refuse to be ourselves. And
let's say that human beings are the one corner of creation that can actually refuse to be themselves. We're the only corner that we know. A mountain is just a mountain. A crow is just a crow. And a grackle is just a grackle. But human beings can actually pretend to be something else. And they can pretend for so long that they forget they're pretending. So the mask you put on in order to defend yourself or not to be found under difficult circumstances perforce becomes your constrained identity. Yeah. So it's always been seen as an incredible achievement for human beings to just be themselves, which is why you should never say to someone who's just about to go on stage, just be yourself. It's the worst advice in the world because it's the most difficult thing to do. The person immediately says, which self are you talking about? The self that's terrified of all of these thousands of people waiting to be.
For me, nature though brings me to the closest, truest, most expansive version of myself. And I think it's because I identify an aspect of myself in those still mountains, in the movement and the flow and the inevitability of life as it presents itself in nature.
Yes, and every different part of the natural world brings out something different in us. You know, being out in the wilds in Australia brings out a very different conversation than being in the wilds in the west of Ireland or the Pacific Northwest of the United States, where I am now. I remember the first time I woke up in Australia, out in the natural world. And you know, in England, when you use the word birdsong, it has a particular kind of lyrical, invitational feeling to it. Well,
it's delicate.
Waking up, yes, it was like hearing Australian birds in the morning. It was like hearing all the lads being kicked out of the pub at 4 o'clock in the morning and none of them wanted to go.
That's a very good description.
I know, I'd never heard a racket like it. So it made me smile. And as well as being a great alarm clock for getting out of the old sleeping bag. But
they're impatient for us to join them, I think. That's the way I see it.
They
want connection. So I think that's a good way for us to get into the creative process of writing. I mean, for you, does being in nature help you with writing your poetry? I know the Wordsworths, I know countless poets and thinkers and philosophers have had to walk to think and to create. And the Wordsworths, of course, William and his sister Dorothy, I think I read they clocked up 290,000 kilometres walking in their lifetimes, and that's about 10 kilometres a day each from the age of 5. I mean, that's phenomenal. Yes. Is that the same for you? Do you walk to get into that poetic space so that you can create?
Well, it's interesting. When I first began writing seriously in my teens, I wrote from when I was probably 7 or 8 years old, but when I became a serious young man and really took poetry seriously, all of my poetry was composed walking at night. And I would memorize it as I went along, and then when I got home, I'd write it down. And that's no longer true, but it was one of my ways in. We're all learning now the benefits of walking and the way it stimulates every system in our body just about. It's one of the greatest things you can do for your health is to walk. And the longer you walk and the brisker you walk, the better you are. But it does open up the mind, and it puts you into a kind of dynamic rest. Yeah. So the ability to walk and pay attention without thinking also But to have thoughts arise and language arise out of the meeting between what you think is you and what you think is not you. I've always found walking a very contemplative act.
Yeah. And I like to say that it goes at the same pace as discerning thought. You know, we emerged as humans with the brains that we have when we became upright and put one foot in front of the other. And so thinking, as we know our thinking as humans to be today, emerged as we got upright and walked. And the pace of walking is conducive to that discernment, that getting to know ourselves.
And I would say so, yes. Yeah.
And I think poetry, writing poetry, reading poetry, engaging with it, does something similar. It gets us into a pace that is conducive to discernment and to expansiveness and knowingness. And I don't want to put words into your mouth at this stage, but I'm wondering if you can explain, because I explained in my intro to this discussion that you introduced me to poetry. You got me loving poetry. I used to skip over poetry bits in books. You know how they have a little quote? And I used to skip over them and I got in the way of the prose, the storyline. I wanted to get straight to plot. But you got me into that stillness. And I'm just wondering if you could, in your own words, explain what poetry does to the human experience.
Well, we've all had the experience of having to say exactly the right thing at exactly the right time to exactly the right person. And most of us have experienced this where either when you're telling someone that you love them for the first time, so it's very important how you say it, your tonal voice, the body language of your language, and how it's received. You know, you have to take it, all of your senses are a tiptoe, as Shakespeare would say. You're really paying attention to who's listening to you. So you're shaping your voice to those ears, because it has to be heard. And the other instance is where you're bringing terrible news to someone, or you're conveying that someone has passed away who both of you love, but particularly the person, someone who's died. You have to say it exactly right, and you have to get through their defenses, but in a way in which you show care for the person who's listening. And you will always, in those circumstances, repeat what you say. You will say what you need to say in three different ways with three different tonal bodies to them. And this is very, very ancient, you know, that you, when something powerful is said, you never understand it fully the first time. I remember in my teens, I lost a close friend who died at the end of the same race that I ran in, a cross-country race. And he literally died at the finish line. He collapsed. And then there were people all around him and trying to resuscitate him. And then he was taken into the changing rooms. And I remember one of the teachers coming out, and I asked, you know, I said, how is he, you know? And he said something to me, and I walked away, and then I literally collapsed 100 yards away, 100 meters away in the sports field, you know, because it had taken that long for me to understand that he died. Even though I heard it, I didn't hear it, but then I had to say it again to myself, and then it struck me. In the Greek theater, when the gods said anything, it was always repeated by the chorus, because a human being could not take in what the gods had said the first time. So it had to be sung or said or chanted again. So this is another power of poetry. First of all, I always say it's language against which we have no defenses. It's said in a way in which you have to admit that there's no argument. It's not didactic. And then there's always this chant, this entrainment, you know, this invitation, and the beauty of the language in which it's said, and the way in which it's said. So all of those things, when you think about it, if you have a big occasion in your life and you have to speak, a person who has never looked at poetry for years will always unconsciously look to poetry for a quote or to recite it, because we may have been turned off poetry by our schooling, which often happens, but we still unconsciously know that poetry is the ultimate way for a human being to speak and to speak to another and to understand their world.
Yeah, I think I've heard you say that poetry gets us out of our own way so that we can almost, and this is my words interlaid over yours, is so that we can almost get to the thing that prose can merely point to. So prose yes. tries to, with lots of words, yeah. explain the thing, but poetry mm. uses less words and points straight at it. And we have to almost go to the spaces between the words to get to the universal thing, the universal knowingness, yeah. the universal connection. And when we get it, it's the gettingness, you know? It's like when you get a plot in a book and you go, oh, my goodness, I feel like I'm part of something bigger. It's the same with poetry. When you get it and you have so few words that were used to get you there, there's almost this sense of expanded knowledge and understanding that you understand. Is that yes. sort of right?
Yeah. There's a very short piece I have at the beginning of my new book of poetry called Still Possible, and it's called For the Road to Santiago, and it gets somewhere very, it's a beginning poem, but I was so surprised by it because, I mean, when you're writing poetry, you're overhearing yourself say things you didn't know you knew, you know, and I had this very powerful experience of that. That's the other dynamic about poetry, actually, is being surprised by what you're saying. So this is for the road to Santiago, Santiago being that very fashionable pilgrimage in northern Spain at the moment. That half the planet was walking until COVID. So this is about setting off, really, on any journey you're on. For the road to Santiago. For the road to Santiago, don't make new declarations about what to bring and what to leave behind. For the road to Santiago, don't make new declarations about what to bring and what to leave behind. Bring what you have. Bring what you have. You're always going that way anyway. You're always going that way all along. For the road to Santiago, don't make new declarations about what to bring and what to leave behind. Bring what you have. Bring what you have. You're always going that way anyway. You're always going there all along. So there's two radical little lines in there that are so surprising. One is don't make new declarations, which immediately I'd say I'm always being told to make new declarations, you know, new resolutions, new senses of myself. I'm supposed to be original. I'm supposed to be creative. You know,
strategizing. It's conjured yeah. strategizing, which yes. goes over the yeah. top of who we really are.
Yeah. So bring what you have. Well, immediately I'm back in my body. I'm saying, what am I already carrying? What do I have? What do I have underneath all this, these outer necessities? Yeah. That's of essence. Yeah. There's a very ancient pilgrimage poem in the Irish monastic tradition. It says, to go to Rome, great the journey, little the gain. To go to Rome, great the journey, little the gain. If you do not bring him with you, you will not find him there. Great the journey, little the gain. If you do not bring him with you, you will not find him there. So that works with the same very powerful ancient dynamic about resting into yourself.
Yeah.
We talked about the restedness in even the wildest landscape. The wind is just the wind. The mountain is the mountain. The river is just the river. And so the sense, you know, human being, what that possibility might be like, just to rest into yourself.
Yeah, in just those two yeah. lines, in the first paragraph of The Road to Santiago, I just immediately go to a sense that everything is okay. I am okay as I am. And if there's something that humans need to be told at every juncture of their life, is that you're okay.
Yes.
You are.
Yeah.
All is as it needs to be.
Yes.
You have all that you need.
Yes. And of course, we can't be Pollyannish about it and think that we've no room for improvement. But there's a difference between putting the world to right because you have a feeling of rightness inside you than putting the world to right because you think there's something wrong at the center of the world. Yeah. And those are two very different identities shaped by a different point of origin. Yeah.
I might move to the actual wild idea that I originally wanted to call you up and talk about, and that is a phraseology that I took from you, and I in fact wrote to you and your people to make sure I could use it in my book, This One Wild and Precious Life, and it's this idea of beautiful questions.
Yes.
And I think you've said one of the most important disciplines is to ask more beautiful questions, and that there's always scope to ask a more beautiful question. Can you explain what the beauty or the worth of a beautiful question is?
Yes, this first occurred to me. I was my good friend and companion, literary and philosophical companion, John O'Donoghue,
the wonderful poet. Yeah.
Yeah, the Irish philosopher poet. Yeah, he was a philosopher poet. I was a poet philosopher. And it was a great loss when he went. And I received many phone calls from talks that he was committed to saying, would you come and speak for John? We've got 300 people all paid up and you're the nearest thing. So, and one of the talks I inherited, actually I inherited a talk on Jesus to about 5,000 Catholics in Los Angeles, which I was shaking my fist at John for, but I managed to carry off somehow and without getting struck by lightning. And another one was the practice of making a more beautiful mind. And the practice of creating a more beautiful mind, it was in Toronto. And I was flying out there to give this talk on John's behalf after he passed away. And I was saying, how do you actually practice having a more beautiful mind? And I came to the conclusion after a good hour's thought, looking out the window at the clouds and everything, that the best way you have of shaping a more beautiful mind, and I started to use the word shaping instead of creating, was by asking really beautiful questions. Questions that took you out of yourself, questions for which you had no immediate answer. And I even had a piece already written about it. It's called Sometimes. Sometimes, if you move carefully through the forest, breathing like the ones in the old stories who could cross a shimmering bed of leaves without a sound. Sometimes, if you move carefully through the forest, breathing like the ones in the old stories who could cross a shimmering bed of leaves without a sound, you come to the place whose only task is to trouble you with tiny but frightening requests, conceived out of nowhere, but in this place, beginning to lead everywhere. Requests to stop what you are doing right now and to stop what you are becoming while you do it. Questions that can make or unmake a life. Questions that have patiently waited for you. Questions that have no right to go away. You come to a place whose only task is to trouble you with tiny but frightening requests, conceived out of nowhere, but in this place, beginning to lead everywhere. Requests to stop what you are doing right now and to stop what you are becoming while you do it. Questions that can make or unmake a life. Questions that have patiently waited for you. Questions that have no right to go away. So even that last question in the poem is a very beautiful thing to ask ourselves. What's the question that has no right to go away in your life right now? You can ask it of your relationship too, you know, for two people together. What's the question that has no right to go away right now? And instinctively, both people already know what it is as soon as they just don't want to face it or say it. but you can turn your face away from it But that question will still be there when you turn your face back. And when while your face is turned away, your life goes into neutral and nothing makes sense anymore. As soon as you turn your face back to the question that has no right to go away, things become real again. Even if you don't have the answer to the question, the fact that you're engaged with what is troubling you and what is inviting you, what is good for you and what's going to break your heart all at the same time. This is called human life. This is called your life. Yeah? So we're constantly living other people's lives out as a kind of defensive mechanism against the heartbreak of our own life. So we attempt an artificial perfection that we perceive in other people's existence. And of course, Instagram and Facebook and all this magnifies the perceived perfection of other people's lives. A real life is always being questioned, I would say, through heartbreak. That whatever ideas you had about yourself, your world, your loved ones, and your society, your planet, you will always have your heart broken on any sincere path that you're going to take. And you need the language for that heartbreak, and you need to feel just as much yourself when you're having your heart broken as you do when you're on top of the world and dispensing advice to everyone else in the world.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You talk about the word besieged in your wonderful book, Consolations. And for those who are unfamiliar with poetry and maybe a bit new to it, you may enjoy David's book, Consolations, because it's sort of small little essays on, is it solace, nourishment, and the underlining meaning of everyday words? And one of them, of course, being besieged. And we are besieged between kind of competing, pulling things, aloneness and needing to belong, work and life, and this notion of work-life balance, which I know you're not a big fan of, finding balance. Asking beautiful questions, I think you've said, is almost the door through which you can walk to be able to navigate that those yes. competing things that besiege us. I think I said recently to someone, I might have even written on Instagram, ironically, that, you know, it's almost like we can't contain our multitudes at the moment. We don't know how to navigate the nuances. Do you feel that yes. poetry and it's like we can't grasp our largeness in this world, you know? We're large. We contain multitudes, as Walt Whitman said.
Yes.
And yet we've almost, as you say, we've turned our face away from that to go numb. And how can we ask more beautiful questions that get us okay and comfortable with the nuance, the grey, the work and the life, the multitudes, the bigness of it all, because it's only going to get bigger, isn't it, David? Like the world is only going to get more and more complex with more and more competing interests and distractions.
Yes. Well,
what are some questions we can ask that can help with that?
Well, I'd say in order to ask those beautiful questions, you have to have a relationship with silence.
Okay.
And you can't ask the really fiercely beautiful questions without that, because it's too frightening and too scary. to the strategic mind that's constantly wanting to have the answer too early in the process. So when you think about it, you know, us, you've been constantly rewarded for having the easy answer. You in class, you know, you got the accolade from the teacher if you got your hand up and said, Miss, sir, I have the answer. And if you were called on, you did have the answer, you were the chosen one and you felt very good about yourself. Yeah. And you never got rewarded for saying, you know, Miss, I have absolutely no idea about what you're talking about, you know, which was probably a common experience for all of us. But I'm really fascinated about where this is leading. You never got rewarded for not knowing. So we have to start building that reward system inside ourselves around silence and around not having the easy answer. I have a line from a poem, which it's a poem which is about a little visit to a holy well in the west of Ireland called Tobor Fordric, or the Well of Patrick. And the first lines are turn sideways into the light, as they say the old ones did, and disappear into the originality of it all. Be impatient with easy explanations. Be impatient with easy explanations and teach that part of the mind that wants to know everything, not to begin questions it cannot answer. Teach that part of the mind that wants to know everything, not to begin questions it cannot answer. The strategic mind, you know, the thing that assigns labels and names, it's an evolutionary friend to us because it allows us to survive. Yeah. But it's not the part of your mind that can grant you any happiness. In fact, its job is to make you anxious, that what you might be hearing is a threat, or to have you worrying about whether you should bring that animal in and skin it, and before other animals get to it, or before the elements get to it, or you need to repair the roof. That part, the part that makes lists, you know, the to-do list, yeah. This is an evolutionary necessity, but it's meant to be a good servant to another part of the psyche, which our great contemplative traditions have recognized, you know,
yeah,
which is the place of origin and originality and silence, yeah, where the new you that's emerging who always appears in your life as a stranger, can be given some hospitality and be invited in. Yeah. Otherwise, whenever you come across a new you, your strategic mind actually labels it as the enemy, as a stranger, as other, yeah, and should not be let in. Yeah. You always meet the new you as a stranger, and you always turn away if you're caught in your strategic mind from the new you, because you cannot believe the changes you'll have to go through to live out the new you you've just discovered.
Yeah. David, can I ask, how do you sit in the silence and practice that and get comfortable with it as a precursor to asking these beautiful questions and accepting the new you into your life? How do you practice it at that tangible level, on a daily level?
Well, lots of different ways. One is walking, as you said earlier, opening the mind and not speaking to yourself. the other is the writing of poetry itself, strangely enough, is another form of deep, you know, the actual spoken word of poetry comes from silence. Otherwise, it's cliche and it's prose, yeah. And then I do have the concentrated discipline, which is I sit on a black cushion facing a wall from my Zen training that I've done. Yeah. So that's just a small portion of my day, though, and I try and carry that concentrated practice. You're probably hearing the dogs outside my windows here going crazy. Yep, that's just part of the world around us. Yeah. And so sitting, I sat Zen quite seriously for many years, but now I carry it with me, and I feel as if I can just carry it with me walking around. But I do every now and again need to get back to it, it's like the real thing, the true drop, yeah, the single malt essence of silence to sit facing the wall intensively.
And it's a pulse, yes, that we have to do for the rest of our life. You can, yes, learn to meditate, and I'm much the same. I'll go through periods where I don't need to do it so much. I'm carrying it, and then I know, yes, when I need to go back to it. I need, yes, to pulse, yeah, back. There's this, yeah, ebb and flow. Yeah.
Yes. I think it's important to say to people who have no meditation in their life, you know, and are put off by the word meditation, that it's much closer than you think, and you don't have to sit on a black cushion facing a wall, at least not to begin with. You can just practice paying attention to things other than yourself, like the trees or the sky, you know, getting out of your house, and the bird song, and
reading poetry. Yes. Takes you to that stillness, like I said before, you know, into that, the spaces, yes, between the words. And the spaces, yes, between the words is that silence.
Yes.
Universal silence.
Yes.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I'd love you to talk a little bit about grief. I remember hearing you on an On Being podcast with Krista Tippett, yeah, I think it was, and you described grief in one of the most beautiful ways, and maybe it hit me because it was something that was very real to me at the moment. But
yes,
you described it as a falling into grief is like, yes, falling into love.
That's, yes,
falling towards something. Can you describe your thoughts around grief?
Yes,
and perhaps via some beautiful questions along the way.
Yeah, I think. A bit like love, the only cure for grief is grief itself. Yeah? And the only cure for the pangs of love is to carry on loving, and till it transforms into something else. So it's a doorway of physical experience. When you lose someone in your life who you love very deeply, a family member or a spouse or, God forbid, a child, you know, it's like losing one of your own limbs, actually. It's like part of your body has been taken away. And so you're brought into direct contact with this powerful sense of absence at the center of the world. And it's interesting that Meister Eckhart, the great Dominican mystic of the 13th century, when he was asked, where is God? He said, nowhere. And he wasn't being facetious. He was really saying that the true experience of God is always through absence. What you feel is missing in your life, you should trust. And you should follow that sense of absence, which, of course, is what we translate as the word longing. You should follow that longing. And it's a very physical journey, and it's a journey of grief, of admitting what you do not have, what you've always wanted, and quite often how you have sabotaged yourself in obtaining the very thing that you want because you're afraid of it. Yeah. So we have so many defensive walls around the sense of absence inside ourselves, the sense of lack. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with lack in a human being so long as you embody it fully, so long as you are following as a sincere pilgrim what you feel is physically missing in your life. Yeah. And you ask the beautiful questions about it. What would I need to do in order to bring that quality or that person or that life or that home into my life? How do I make the invitation?
I think you've also described this idea like falling in love, you're falling towards something. And with falling into grief, you're yes. falling and you fall through one floor, you fall through another, and you're not arriving at that thing because that thing is now gone. And when you finally do crash, because you do, you land at that part of yourself that will now need to take the place of the thing that is missing. And I found that the comforting part of this idea of grief is as getting comfortable with the thing that's missing.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure you could use that word comfort, getting comfortable with in the same breath. Yeah. It's an experience of kind of atomization and undoing, just as falling in love is. Yeah. And so it's the ability to arrange for your own disappearance in a way.
Which is not so comfortable.
You always know when you're getting close to the truth because you start speaking absolute nonsense. But you do have to arrange for your own disappearance. You know, you're going to be kidnapped by reality, abducted by what calls you on. That's how I felt I love poetry from when I was little because my mother fed me a lot of it and recited it in Irish and English late at night at my bedside. But when I reached up at Tiptoe in the local library when I was 11 or 12 years old and pulled down from the very top shelf this book of poetry by Tom Gunn and the Yorkshire poet whose name has just escaped me right now, I read those lines and I literally felt as if I'd been abducted by a passing hawk, like this claws had got into me, lifted me up and were carrying me off with beating wings. That's how I felt when I read those guys. Yeah, it was, this is the real stuff. My God, you know, I also felt this is how, these are adults who have kept the primary vision of childhood alive into adulthood. I don't know if you remember that feeling as a child, most children have it, of listening to the adult world around you and saying to yourself, these people are crazy. These people are insane. They've forgotten the priorities of existence, the things they're concerned with, the thing they're worried about, the things they criticize other people for. These people are in a state of amnesia. You wouldn't say that as a child, but that's what you're thinking. Yeah, you wouldn't use that word, but they've forgotten. Mm-hmm. And when I read poetry, true, you know, fierce adult poetry for the first time when I was 12 or 13, I said, these are adults who have kept my primary vision that I have alive into maturity. And so it's possible actually to stay alive. Part of me was thinking there's this inevitable demise of the spirit into adulthood until that moment. So that was, you know, there was the grief, there was the abduction, and there was the transformation all in one movement.
Isn't it interesting as an adult, I use the word comfort and you know, you took umbrage with that description of getting comfortable with the unknown, getting comfortable with that disappearance or disintegration. And as kids, we didn't choose comfort. In fact, it was the discomfort that we would go towards. It was the cold water that we would insist on staying in, you know, when all the adults would say, come on, we've got to get out of here, it's freezing. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Like our original most innocent space is to be uncomfortable. Yes. And yet we live in a culture that tries to cocoon children from any kind of discomfort. And so
yes.
I don't know if you feel the same way, but I look around and I see a generation of children that aren't getting to be kids as a result of this cocooning.
Yeah, it's a worldwide concern, you know, and the fact that they're kept away from going out into the wild or even just into the local field or woods, you know.
Or to not know things, like everything is micromanaged and they can Google anything. They can now even Siri or, you know, Alexa without actually having to lift a finger to find something some piece of information. Hey, David, I'm aware of time, but I do want to talk about your latest book of poetry, which I think will probably be able to be purchased here in Australia in a couple of months, Still Possible, which I think is the perfect title for the times. Can you tell me what's still possible? Or maybe I should say, what do we fear is not possible? What were you attending to when you wrote this book?
Well, I think it was written, you know, in this very study that I'm speaking to you from now, in the best and quietest corner of the pandemic that I could find.
And you're on another island, aren't you?
Yes, that's right. And I mean, all of us had very mixed experiences of the lockdown and the particular form of lockdown that we were in. You were in a very fierce lockdown in Australia, and very hard on individuals and on society. My circumstances were very good, but even so, there was a kind of claustrophobia. And I realized, I was asking the beautiful question, will it be possible to go out in the world again in the way that we were involved with it before? And part of the understanding was actually, the way we were involved before was actually quite manic. And we were all charging around the planet at great speed, and going hither and thither. And part of me was actually tremendously relieved not to have to cross time zones, the exhaustion of travel, I love travel so much that I was helpless to say no to it in a way. So I got this beautiful experience, but the great question was, what is still possible? And I realized actually that's a question human beings ask of themselves at almost every epoch of their life. When you cross from teenhood into your 20s, you have questions about, is it still possible to have the wildness I had as an adolescent in my young adulthood? When you go from young adulthood to responsibility in your 30s, is it still possible to carry that sense of adventure you had in your 20s? And through every epoch in your life, 40s, 50s, 60s, we are unconsciously asking ourselves, what's still possible? Now, I often think that there's a form of youthfulness that's possible to you in your 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s that was actually prohibited to you when you were in your 20s. And it comes through actually maturity. There's that old saying, which is so true, about youth being wasted on the young. So what is still possible? So this is a piece from the title poem, which is many, many pages long, going through what is all.
I think it's your longest poem, isn't it?
It's competing, but this is one stanza from it, which is a fancy poetic way of saying one paragraph. It's not too late to imagine that the days to come are the lost children you are still to bring to birth. It's not too late to imagine that the days to come are the lost children you are still to bring to birth and bring to maturity, and that you are ready once more to be selfless on their behalf, setting them to rights when they fall, listening when they lose faith, being that mother or father who, through all their difficulties, gives the gift of constant witness. So it's interesting, the dogs are going crazy outside again. The sense that you could be the ancestor of your future happiness, that what you do today, your future self could come back and thank you for. Just as when we reach our own maturity, we go back in our minds and thank our own mother and father for things they did for us that we were unappreciative of at the time and we took for granted. And it's only when we reach maturity ourselves that you realize how much every individual has on their plate. And not only did they have the whole of reality on their plate, but they had us on their plate too at the same time. And they were very good in certain ways.
Very much feeds into the climate situation as well, of course. Because exactly. we are ancestors to the future yeah. life on this planet. Was that yes. something that plays into your thinking?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's very difficult for us to face up to changing our behavior around climate because it doesn't fit into any of our mythological stories where you always had to have a personification of evil against which you were fighting. Yeah. And so human beings are not made to actually grapple with this kind of story, which is in just a slight abstract. It's very real, but from a mythological point of view, it's an abstract. So we actually have to change our imaginative identity. And of course, the personification of difficulty in this stage is ourselves, actually.
Yeah.
And just walking around the house, wasting all the things that we waste, you know, and throw in the bin.
We're both the enemy and the yes. victim in this climate war. And that's a very unusual space to be in.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're looking at an imaginative transformation, but we're also looking at the early stages of the real disappearance of transnational borders, because you can't have a selfish nationalism and deal with the dynamics of climate change at the same time. You can't be just Australian and say we're going to produce and burn coal as much as we want. You know, you can't. Yeah, you can't be. You can't be from whatever inheritance you're from and have an excuse because that's part of your inheritance. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with coal fires. I love coal fires.
From Yorkshire.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And a coal fire, an open coal fire, is one of the most beautiful things in the world. And all the transformations it goes through and the late heat that it throws off, you know, I have to let go of that. You know? I grew up with Land Rovers. You know, I grew up tinkering with Land Rovers. I grew up fixing Land Rovers. I grew up driving across Europe to Turkey in Land Rovers. It was Land Rovers, Land Rovers, Land Rovers, you know. I have a Land Rover now. I will not buy another internal combustion engine Land Rover. It's electric. A big part of my psyche. I have to let it go. When they make an electric one, I'll get one. But until then, you know, all of us have these inherited precious parts of our existence that we suddenly go, oh my God, you know, really, am I asked to stop doing this? Yeah.
What's the beautiful question then, David, that we can ask ourselves in this space where there is still so much that is still possible? What is the beautiful question?
I think it's I just did the write-up for my three Sunday series in January, which is three Sunday more. It's a series. And the theme is around simplification. I think the real invitation is to simplify your life. Yeah. And that's not to create a kind of Puritanism where you're not enjoying anything and not going anywhere. But all of us have to go through some kind of radical simplification where we don't quite need as much. So
the beautiful question is, how much do we need? What do we need? How much can we let go of? What can we let go of?
Yes. And what kind of happiness might await for me? In not just the sense of doing without, but some other giftedness that all of our great monastic traditions have understood, you know, in every culture on earth, all of our great native traditions, you give everything up, you go out in the wilderness, you know, you reduce your life down to the essentials and you pay attention from that place. And there's another kind of giftedness that is possible from that place.
Yeah, that leads beautifully into my absolutely final question that I like to ask a select few guests on Wild, and that is, if we lose it all, what is left? And I suppose it's a question that invites you to think, or to tell us, share with us, what essentially matters when all the guff, all the fuss, all the layers of complexity and commodification is gone. And even when perhaps we lose the world that we love so much, what is at the essence of our human experience that is still possible?
Yes, you're really talking about a kind of death. Mm-hmm. And this is a piece from the book Still Possible, which works with that. What's on the other side of you having to give up?
Yes.
And in this case, it's to give up your life, but also it's giving up holding on to your life. I mean, it's a cliche that we have to die in order to live, but it's a cliche because it's so stubbornly true. You have to get over yourself, get beyond yourself. So this is called Beyond Santiago. I read a poem earlier, which was for the road to Santiago. Death is so simple. Death is so simple. One moment you are alive, and then you are not. One moment you're alive, and then you are not. And that fear you carry with you might be equally as simple too. That you'll never have the time to accomplish what you wish. But stop a moment now before the way beyond, and let me tell you this. Stop a moment now before the way beyond, and let me tell you this. You will go out of this life, however untimely, having completed every single thing you wished. You will arrive in that night like a newborn child, welcomed by loving arms. You will find in that long anticipated enemy the ultimate form of forgiveness and friendship. Every fearful goodbye suddenly become a gentle getting to know. A getting to know of a forgiveness that was strangely always anticipated. A getting to know of a forgiveness that was strangely always anticipated. A welcome and a full understanding of all you ever did. Everything you gave and everything you were given. And then everything you could never give. And above all, everything you could never bring yourself to receive. Those unattainable distances that always broke your heart, and the gifted understanding of why it was so hard for you to love, the gifted understanding of why it was so hard for you to love. And then, and most importantly, and right to the heart, everything you were and everything you gave that was never, ever on your list. And then, and most importantly, everything you were and everything you gave that was never, ever on your list.
That's a wonderful, wonderful note to end on. And I have tears of recognition, as I often do when you recite your poetry, David.
Lovely.
That's what poetry is. It's a mutual recognition, right? That
exactly,
we're in this together.
Yeah, breaking down of the... Well, it's lovely to chat with you across the oceans. And I look forward to a world in which we can walk the Lake District again together. So.
Me too. And thank you for introducing me to such a wonderful community. That community, we've stayed in touch, and there's some wonderful souls who are now very much part of my life through that shared experience that you create for us. Thank you once again. And we will be looking out for your poetry book when it arrives here in Australia.
Very good. Thank you, Sarah. All the best now.
I don't think I'll go into a pithy overview of, you know, the episode, as I sometimes do on this podcast. I think David's words need to land exactly as they are, because they're kind of perfect. Although, let me just share two thoughts that really grabbed me in the discussion. The first is the notion of practicing the making of a beautiful mind. I think that is a template for living, really. The second, and I think I've got this quote right, Cassie, a real life is this idea of being questioned by heartbreak. And I think the invitation that David presents here is to get very accepting of the pain of life and to understand the worth of it and to enable the questions, the beautiful questions that come out of that pain. And of course, we ask so many deep questions when we are in pain. And it's just such a relief to know that they're important and so worthy. Cassie, I might actually get you to share what actually dropped for you in the chat, because you listened through the whole lot, I know.
I really loved the relationship with silence.
Yeah.
And then the need of the relationship with silence. It comes from, you know, a childhood of being constantly rewarded for having the easy answer, but not being rewarded for asking and saying, I have no idea what you're talking about, that we need to find a way to reward ourselves for not having the easy answer. That really resonated with me.
Totally agree. Look, as a parting note, as we move into our future life, as David would put it, I just want to flag that my Live Nation tour is back on in February, March, and I'll be asking a number of beautiful questions of ourselves, of our life, of our engagement in the climate crisis ahead of the next election here in Australia. The tour is in February and into March, finishing off in Sydney. And you can get all the details now at my website, sarahwilson.com. And I'd love to see you there. If you've already got tickets, those tickets will be passed on to these new dates. It's going to be a really important conversation, and I'm really excited about seeing you all in real life. Anyway, until then, as Albert Camus would say, live your life to the point of tears and stay wild.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.